copyright Forum of Christian Leaders. The contents contained on this website are solely for your own individual, non-commercial, and informational use. Any other use is strictly prohibited without our express prior written consent. See the full copyright disclosure at focalonline.org.
So welcome, everyone. It is a joy to be together with you. My name is Roxana Stanciu, and I serve as Chief Operating Officer of CARE, a Christian charity that is based in the United Kingdom. I'm also one of the co-leaders of the Politics and Society Network here at ELF. It's really wonderful to see you all and to see some very familiar faces of good friends, and also some other participants that I look forward to getting to know better a bit later. Our vision at CARE is to see a society that has a greater regard for human dignity and increasingly reflects God's grace and truth through public policy, media, and local practical involvement with vulnerable people. At CARE, we work on issues in relation to family, life, and justice, and we are represented in the UK Parliament and assemblies. Well, the topic of today's workshop is caring for the most vulnerable, unborn babies and their mothers. We are going to look at this topic from a few different angles. We are going to explore the biblical perspective. Then we are going to look at what science, law, and culture say on the topic. We will then talk about what is our responsibility as Christians and see what God is calling us to do. The Bible tells us that children are to be cherished because they are so precious. But we live in a society where children are often seen as a problem to be avoided. Unwanted, clump of cells, non-persons, these are the words that our culture often connects with the status of an unborn baby. Unborn babies are often mistreated and devalued in today's world, where abortion is seen as a quick fix for the problems that they supposedly create. $43 million abortions take place every year around the world. That is approximately 125,000 abortions per year. That is 125,000 abortions today. This means that of every 100 human deaths on this planet, 43 of them involve babies whose lives are being taken. Every year, abortion ends 1/5 of the pregnancies worldwide and 1/3 of pregnancies in Europe. These figures are heartbreaking. To put this in perspective, tragically, there have been about 3.5 million deaths due to COVID in the last year. This is absolutely terrible, and so many people have lost loved ones under very difficult circumstances. In the same 12-month period, there have been 43 million deaths through abortion worldwide. Behind the 43 million, there are some absolutely tragic stories. But our culture decides that some lives are more important than others, that some lives matter and others do not. We never hear anything on the news about the 43 million deaths of unborn babies. They are usually forgotten. This is really sad. But this is not just statistics. Behind each number, there are men and women who have been traumatized, people who have stories of pain, grief, and deep emotional wounds. And yet, abortion is often called a basic healthcare need. We have seen that access to abortion has been facilitated in most countries of Europe and beyond Europe, even in the midst of the pandemic. Even more so, legislation around abortion has been liberalized in some countries for this very purpose. Why do these numbers speak to us? Well, because each individual life speaks to us of God's love and plan for humanity, of the possibilities that each human life brings into the world, because babies matter, mothers matter, and fathers matter. The There is only one worldview that has the intellectual resources to protect mothers and unborn babies, Christianity. As Daniel Darling says, there is no basis for human dignity without a connection to God. The Bible's robust view of humanity is one of the best gifts that Christianity gives to the world. Human beings are made in the image of God for His glory. We stand out from the rest of the creation. The first introduction we have of this comes very early on in the Bible. In Genesis 1, we read, "Then God said, 'Let us make humankind in our image, according to our likeness.' So God created humankind in His image. In the image of God, He created them." When commenting on this passage, John Wyatt says that human beings are not self-explanatory. We derive our meaning from outside of ourselves, from God, in whose image we are made. We are images, we are reflections of another reality. The dignity of our humanity comes precisely from outside of ourselves. It comes from God, whose image we bear. The Bible is very clear that God's love is for all humans, including the unborn. That is very obvious in Psalm 139. We read, "For it was you who formed my inward parts. You knit me together in my mother's womb. My frame was not hidden from you when I was being made in secret." Psalm 139 portrays God's intimate involvement and concern for the psalmist's life, which developed in the womb. The author marvels at God's omniscience and omnipresence and makes some very important statements about the unborn baby. The psalmist describes the God who is setting his life up with days that he has not yet lived out. God sees and knows all of his life. This is so precious. In a similar way, Job says that God created him at the beginning of his life. Then Jeremiah says that God called him to be a prophet even before birth. One of the New Testament writers, Dr. Luke, and I think that the fact that he was a doctor is very special. He records Mary's and Elizabeth's pregnancy story. He records the life in the womb of Jesus and of John the Baptist. He tells us that John the Baptist in the womb of his mother gave a perfectly human response to the news of the conception of Christ, and he was filled with the Holy Spirit before birth. He even leaped inside the womb. Jesus' life in the womb has a huge significance, and God is making a very clear statement about the value of the unborn child through that. Journalist Matt Walsh writes, "Jesus was himself at one point an unborn child. If there were any questions before his arrival about the sanctity of human life, those questions were answered 2,000 years ago. We were created to reflect God's glory. That is telling us how significant human life is. As John Wyatt puts it, the consistent witness of the biblical writers is that the fetus is part of the human drama, a hidden actor on the human stage, one whom God is creating in secret, calling into existence and into relationship with himself." But what does science have to say about all of this? Well, science actually confirms what the Bible tells us, that human life begins at conception. Technological advances such as ultrasound scanning and research on fetal development prove that. Once the union of a sperm and egg occurs, the 23 chromosomes of each are brought together into one cell that has 46 chromosomes. That one cell has all the DNA that will make the human being. This is a reality that is recognized even by the promoters of abortion. That is why our reasons against abortion are moral and logical at the same time. Science clearly shows that around 21 days, long before the mother even knows that she is pregnant, the first irregular beats occur in the developing heart. At 8 weeks in the womb, the baby can feel and react to pain and has all of the organs necessary to support life. and yet it is legal to take his or her life. Ironically, surgeons are increasingly performing surgery on unborn children, and sometimes they apply anesthesia to numb their pain. While in the same medical facility, doctors are ending the lives through abortions of babies in similar stages of development. One might ask, if science is so clear about the beginning of life, then why is the culture of abortion prevailing? At the heart of this is the personhood debate, whether a baby in the womb deserves the right to life, as all people do, whether his or her life is worthy of protection. Nancy Piercy explains that abortion rests on personhood theory. For today's culture, being human is not enough to qualify for personhood. The unborn baby has to earn the status of personhood by achieving and exercising the capacity for consciousness, self-awareness, and autonomy. The unborn baby is defined by what he or she values. This theory sees no value in the living human body and creates a new category of individual, the human non-person. This theory drastically dehumanizes all of us, because a key part of our identity is lost if our bodies have no inherent value. The Bible clearly contradicts the personhood theory and emphasizes that no human being needs to earn the right to be treated with respect and dignity. Our dignity is intrinsic. Francis Schaeffer emphasized that if man is not made in the image of God, nothing then stands in the way of inhumanity. If membership in the human species does not mean that someone is a person, then it falls to whoever has the most power to decide the criteria for who is a person and who is not a person. And those who promote abortion do not want for unborn babies to be persons. It is as simple as that. A well-known abortionist said, "Not everybody is meant to be born. I believe that for a baby, life begins when his mother wants him." This is not new. We have seen this in history before. A really good pro-life author, Randy Alcorn, explains, "Whites once decided that blacks were less human. Men decided women had fewer rights. Nazis decided Jews' lives were not meaningful. Now big people decide that little people are not meaningful enough to have rights." Today's society finds a way to demote the unborn baby. The baby is not called the baby, but is called the zygote, the embryo, the fetus. Words that imply that he or she is not fully human. Let's see what the law says about this. Historically, the lives of the unborn have been protected by laws by law as a result of Judeo-Christian principles. But in the last 50 years, legislation in much of the Western world, and not only in the Western world, has moved away from these principles to accommodate abortion. Unborn children no longer receive the protection they once did. In most of the countries of Europe and beyond Europe, abortion has become legal and is promoted in the name of equality and freedom. In fact, Malta is the only country in the EU who does not allow abortion under any circumstances. Poland's law shows a high level of protection for unborn babies and mothers and only allows abortion under very narrow circumstances. But those who promote abortion often refer to human rights when they do so. But there is no right to abortion enshrined in any international treaty. Article 3 of the Declaration of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights proclaims that everyone has the right to life. The Convention of the Rights of the Child states that every child has the inherent right to life, and that the child, by reason of his physical and mental immaturity, needs special safeguards and care, including appropriate legal protection before as well as after birth. Sadly, the huge push for abortion that we see in today's culture contradicts the principles enshrined in international treaties. Abortion is a very complex issue that is often associated with feminism. But unlike many 21st century feminists, early feminists were strongly opposed to abortion and actively campaigned against it. Alice Paul, a famous feminist of the early 1900s, called abortion the ultimate exploitation of women. Susan Anthony, another famous feminist, said that when a woman destroys the life of her unborn child, it is a sign that by education or circumstances, she has been greatly wronged. However, things changed and second wave feminism took turn in the 1960s, and it aggressively campaigned for reproductive freedom, which includes abortion. Former abortionist Dr. Bernard Nathanson stated that in the 1960s, he and his fellow abortion rights strategists deliberately linked abortion to the women's issue, so it could be furthered not on its own merits, but on the merits of women's rights. We see that very clearly in our society today. Abortion is promoted in the name of women's freedom. It is promoted in the name of equality, justice, and even love. But the irony in that is that abortion is robbing women of their most basic right, the right to life. A huge analysis of worldwide population data from 1970 to 2017 suggests that sex-selective abortion has led to at least 23 million fewer girls being born. Many societies value sons over daughters, so there has been a rise in families choosing to abort female unborn babies. While the majority of these missing girls are in China and India, sex-selective abortion is also performed in Western societies. Abortion has become a means of eliminating unwanted females across the globe, and this is a tragedy. Abortion has completely failed as a social policy designed to aid women, writes Serin Foster, president of Feminists for Life. It is a reflection that we have failed women. Nancy Piercy argues that a culture that promotes abortion disrespects women's unique contribution to the task of reproduction, and it disrespects their bodies. It does not value and protect women, but it seeks to suppress their body functions by using chemicals and violent procedures to destroy the life inside of them. Abortion does not create a society where women can flourish. Actually, abortion is against women. The current feminist narrative says that abortion liberates women from patriarchy, from being controlled by men. This narrative is flawed. Let's see why. Pro-abortion feminists say that women have total autonomous control over their pregnant bodies. But that argument encourages male disengagement and irresponsibility. It allows men to take sexual favors without any responsibility for the consequences, since the woman has to take sole responsibility for the pregnancy. A liberal abortion policy actually encourages male patriarchy. Then the pro-abortion feminist narrative suggests that there is a battle between the interests of the mother and the interests of the unborn baby. But it is bizarre to conceive pregnancy as a battle between the unborn baby and the mother. The interests of the mother and the baby are in the same direction, not opposed. What is good for the mother is good for the baby, and vice versa. Abortion enforces the false narrative that a woman has to choose between being a mother and pursuing her dreams. Something that is often overlooked by feminists is the fact that males frequently coerce women to have abortions, but this is concealed by women out of fear or shame. a liberal abortion policy facilitates coercive control of men over women and does not facilitate women to make decisions. There is clear evidence of the lifelong adverse consequences that abortion has on some women. This evidence is systematically suppressed and downplayed by feminists. It is not in women's interests to deceive them about the truth. It seems like the abortion lobby does not believe that women are capable of making good decisions when presented with the facts. There is a silent grief that is carried by so many in our society. There are numerous negative physical, psychological, and emotional consequences of abortion that can affect women for a lifetime. Yet most women are not informed of these serious consequences. Studies show that 81% of women who had an abortion were found to be at an increased risk for mental health problems, including depression, alcohol and drug abuse, post-traumatic stress syndrome, and suicidal behaviors. Then many doctors agree that abortion increases the rates of breast cancer, preterm births, infections, and many other physical complications. So we were talking about the complications that women who experience post-abortion, the complications that women who experience an abortion can go through. And studies, surveys of women who experience post-abortion complications show that more than 90% of women say that they were not given enough information to make an informed choice. Then more than 80% say that it is very likely that they would have not aborted if they had not been so strongly encouraged to abort by others. Then 83% of those women say that they would have carried to term if they had received support from their family, from their partners, and from society. Then 75% of women who have aborted claimed that they were driven by either social or economic constraints. The reality is that women in our society are exploited through abortion. Then abortion discriminates against unborn babies with disabilities and tells people with disabilities that they are not wanted. Very encouragingly, different countries have adopted a variety of policies in order to ensure that there is no discrimination against disabled people. We see special parking and elevators being provided for disabled people. We see special Olympics that are being organized and a lot of statements being made about the value that disabled people bring to our society. And all of that is absolutely true. But then most women who carry a child with disabilities are pressured into having an abortion. Abortion rates for prenatal diagnosis of Down syndrome are extremely high. Nearly 100% in Iceland, 98% in Denmark, 80 to 90% in Norway, and 90% in the UK. None of the European institutions condemn the discrimination of disabled people through abortion policies and legislation in Europe and beyond. And this creates a culture that tells disabled people in our society that they are not welcomed. They are not wanted because they do not meet the standards. It also creates a culture that tells parents that they have the right to choose only the most desirable children. The question is, who decides whether someone is desirable or unwanted? Wanting is simply someone's very subjective feeling toward another. The value of a person does not depend on whether he or she is wanted. You see here a picture of Heidi Krauter, who is a disability rights campaigner who is very, very bravely challenging the UK's discriminatory abortion laws. At the moment, you can abort up to birth in Great Britain for cases of serious disability, which includes Down syndrome. Similar legislation exists in many other countries in Europe and worldwide. Heidi states that people like me are considered to be seriously handicapped. But I think using that phrase for a clause in abortion law is so out of date. In a press interview, she said, "My life has as much value as anyone else's," and we couldn't agree more. Millions of women and men, both in society and in churches, are suffering under the shame and guilt of abortion. What we can do as Christians, what are the ways in which we can get involved? Well, the solution begins with me, with you, with each of us. And I believe that the first thing that we can do is pray. Abortion is more than a legal and a political battle. It is a spiritual battle. In the Bible, Paul described what we are dealing with as powers and principalities. Therefore, we need to ask for God's grace and mercy. We need to persevere and pray. We need to pray for God to stop the injustice of abortion, for God's people to have courage, wisdom, and compassion, and to support expectant mothers and fathers who face difficult situations. We need to pray for God to meet the needs of women who face very difficult situations. And then we also need to lament the 43 million yearly aborted lives, but also give thanks for every baby who is rescued from being aborted. And then after praying, we must take action. John Wyatt says that abortion has become a highly polarized and toxic issue in our society. And he continues, "But I believe that when we try to enter this battleground, our Christian task is first to listen and to understand, to empathize. Only in this way are we going to be able to speak with integrity, with authenticity and compassion." The context in which Christians are called to speak and to act is a very difficult one, which is why often our default position is to keep quiet, to be silent. This happens both in conversations with non-Christian friends, and it also happens in the church. There are a few reasons for that. First of all, the subject is very sensitive, and we don't know how to start. And then secondly, we don't always take the time to look into the arguments and develop firm convictions. But we need to speak out about the greatest human rights violation of our time. We need to understand, to get involved, to show that being pro-life means caring about the unborn babies and their mothers, both before birth and after birth. Daniel Darling explains that to be pro-life is a way of life. It is an approach that moves us to lend our voices, our prayers, our influence, and our resources to come alongside those whose flourishing is being threatened and whose dignity is being assaulted. In order to cultivate the right attitude in caring for women, it is important to understand the reasons behind their choice to have an abortion. The Guttmacher Institute found that there are three most common reasons. One, the concern for or responsibility to other individuals. Another reason is women not affording to raise a child. The third reason is women fearing that having a baby would make them unable to continue with work, with school, or the ability, or it would affect the ability for them to care for dependents. These reasons are huge challenges that women face every day. They are also issues that the church must step in and address. It would be wonderful for all of us to work toward a time when the society sees Christians as a group who will encourage women and provide emotional, financial, and spiritual support, both for them and for their unborn child. It would be beautiful to build a culture where people are less likely to choose abortion because the church has shown women that Christians and Christianity will give a better life for them and for their child. This may seem overwhelming, I agree, but God can help us. He can enable us to be loving and kind towards our neighbors. We need to support mothers and provide for children, regardless of what the abortion policies say, and regardless of whether they change or not. We need to show love in action and demonstrate the practical reality of the gospel. In James chapter 1, verse 27, we read that God's people should give special care to women without husbands and to children without fathers. When we think about this, we see that the unborn babies and their sometimes unmarried mothers are in the category of those whom we owe a very special duty of care and protection. Nancy Piercy says that it is crucial that the church once again becomes known as a place that values women. Rejecting abortion is a way of expressing respect not only for the child, but also for the mother. The church should also strive to be known as a sanctuary for those wounded by the callous cynicism of the abortion culture. We need to create a culture in our churches where those who made the very sad decision to have an abortion can find forgiveness, grace, and hope. A culture where they can feel safe. A culture where they do not have to fear that they will be judged and where they can feel loved. A culture that proves the biblical truth that there is grace for those who made the decision to terminate the pregnancy. CARE runs a ministry called Open, which aims at creating an environment within churches where unintended pregnancy and post-abortion concerns can be shared with grace and compassionate understanding. Open is led by a wonderful lady, Jenny Baines, and she shares a story about the importance of showing grace to women who have been through an abortion. I'm quoting Jenny's words now. So she says, while spending time in a church in the US, I visited a lady who with great courage and many tears had attended our post-abortion healing group. At the side of the road leading into her town was a huge banner which read, abortion stops a beating heart. I asked her how she had felt with her secret guilt and grief over 30 years, driving past that banner each day. She replied that she had learned to harden her heart to it as she knew only too well the deep pain of having made that decision which ended her baby's life. She later reflected more on this and said, Jenny, it is true that abortion stops a beating heart, but here is one step further. Who will care for the hearts that remain beating but broken? This is the message that God called us to share. Jesus came to heal the brokenhearted. You can find the story that I mentioned in one of the recommended books in your outline. It is so important for Christians to have conversations with those around them and make them aware of the reality of abortion and uphold human dignity and the value of the unborn whenever they have the opportunity. This might lead to us becoming unpopular. It is not easy, but we need to be brave enough to stand on the side of an unpopular cause. We are never alone or without help in this, because Jesus has promised that he will not leave us nor forsake us. Moreover, when we have those conversations, we always have good news to share because we have a message of forgiveness and a message of grace. Another way of taking action is by getting involved in the public debate around abortion. You can write to your MP, for instance, and or to your other elected representatives and share your concerns about abortion and encourage them to promote positive alternatives to abortion. You can also get involved in public advocacy yourself if this is what God calls us to do. Maybe you feel called to open up your homes for foster care or for adoption, or maybe God calls you to start a pro-life ministry in your church and maybe counsel women who have experienced an abortion. Another option would be to financially support a crisis pregnancy center in your area. Google them. You might find one that is quite close to you. I do not know what the Lord is calling you to, but I know that if we call ourselves pro-life, we cannot be indifferent to the topic of abortion. And we must take action in whatever way God has equipped us to. And maybe one day we will look back, and just like with slavery, we will wonder how our society could ever allow abortion in the first place. Maybe one day, by God's grace, we can see a culture that clearly affirms that a person is a person, no matter how small. Let's pray and work for that day to come. Thank you.